there's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
We are live. Welcome, folks, to episode 3570 of the Survival Podcast. It's a Tuesday. That means you're going to have a Just Jack show, and we're going to drill down on a subject. I mentioned a little bit about this yesterday, this idea that if we want to be able to eat high-quality protein, we're going to have to, at least on some level, produce some of it for ourselves, as we were talking about all the problems in the country. And I got up this morning, and I had two ideas for a show. And this is why you should follow me on X, because it's just where I get more interaction with something like this. So it's where I put polls. If somebody needs to make polls available universally on Noster in some way, by the way, or I would do it there. But I ran a poll and said I can either do a basics of prepping, like a fundamentals of prepping episode we haven't done in a while, or I can do backyard livestock versus the war on meat. And the war on meat won by about 20% of the vote, so 20% more of the vote. So it was like something like a, you know, kind of like a 60-40, but it wasn't quite that, because there was like 6% other ideas for a show, which I do quite frequently. And I do that quite frequently with the other when I run polls, because sometimes it gives me a good idea for a future show as well. I'm never going to probably do it the day of that day, because my head has to already be there when I wake up to get it ready by around noon. And Mike's Farm says 1 p.m. Eastern start. Absolutely. 12 Central Daylight Time, 1 p.m. Eastern. That's how the time zones work, Mike. Anyway, so we're going to dig into that today. Before we do, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. Sponsor today, number one today, is JM Bullion. JM Bullion is my place that I go to whenever I want to stack silver and or gold. And I think it should be your place, too, and I'll tell you why. Number one, free shipping on all orders. Number two, better pricing than like Monex, Apmex, Lear Capital, the larger, better known silver gold houses. And number three, I can directly speak to the president of the company anytime I need to, though I haven't had to for quite some time because they're just that good at what they do. And number four, they will give you a discount if you're an MSB member. I don't know a lot of places you can get a discount on silver and gold. It's a very thin margin business to begin with. But you can do that through the MSB program, and they've been a sponsor of this show, so I'll give you five reasons for about 10 years now, a decade of sponsorship in that industry and for a podcast. That's a pretty big deal. They support us, so you should support them. Silver and gold belong in your wealth assurance program. Next up today is Anton's Land of Biltong. We're going to be talking about producing protein today. But one of the best things that you can do with high-quality red meat protein is to make biltong out of it. But if you don't want to do it yourself, you want to give it a try, you want to actually try it made by a guy who grew up in South Africa, knows how to make it the traditional way, check out Anton's Land of Biltong. I actually get part of his sponsorship payment in biltong and Doer sausages sent to me twice a month, and you can too, or you can order one off. He's got a lot of other really cool stuff. And Anton, again, will be at the November workshop if you're coming to that. Anyway, so let's dig on into this subject. And I want to start off with the idea that some people present that there is no war on meat. Like it's not a thing. It's just, it's made up. It's crazy right wing Jim Bro talk. Some of the ways I've seen pushback on it amount to something akin to, right-wing white guys are afraid to eat vegetables or something like that. Like anything they can do to shame you. And that's actually part of the proof, in my opinion anyway, that it's a real thing, that it's a real problem. And this is what I mean. If you go to Google or Brave Search or anything like that, and you search for war on meat, the initial results are all stacked. And they're all stacked to, you're crazy. There's no war on meat. It's not a thing. Why would you say such a thing? You know, like it's just as a right-wing conspiracy or whatever. But the same articles, one, will shame you for wanting to eat meat. And then two, will make the case of, yeah, there's no war on meat. But, you know, if you care at all about the planet, et cetera, you shouldn't be eating meat because it's boiling the oceans or whatever. So the very media propaganda pieces that tell you there is no war on meat, they also tell you why you shouldn't eat meat, which is part of the whole war on meat. But why would they want to do this? Why would what do you think the real driving motivation is as to this idea that we shouldn't be eating meat, especially red meat? Like, that's the worst of all. Like, chicken and pork are bad, but beef super bad. Like, it's worse than Orange Man bad. Why do you guys that are here in the live chat, why do you think that they don't want us eating meat? And it's just to encourage bug eating. I think there is something. Boiling the oceans. Lobsters. Cattle herds are down around 15 to 20% in the U.S. This is driving up the cost of beef. Chicken will be a huge driving force of protein. Agree, but that's not why. Why? Anti-human agenda in general from Jeffrey. Beat for you. I'm not sure what that means. Doesn't domesticate you the way they want you. I think that's a good answer. Meat keeps us healthy. They don't want us healthy, I guess, is the implication. They want us sick and stupid. It's nutritious. They don't want us healthy. I'm reading people's responses here for those on the audio only. They want to keep the best food for themselves to make you sick. They want you weak. They want you sick. Interesting how many people said some version of they want you sick. They don't want you healthy. Because my first reason is they don't want a strong, healthy population. They don't want a strong, healthy population. If you look back historically, the idea that you should eat, you know, grains and potatoes and starches historically is very ancient. And it was almost always issued as a decree by the wealthy elite that primarily ate meat. You know, the king owned all the deer in England. And if you shot a deer in England, anywhere in England, unless you were part of the king's group, you were a poacher. You're not, but the king ate venison all the time. And you can find examples of this throughout history. All the elites, sometimes the priests, you know, and now there's some truly vegetarian or vegan religions like Buddhism, like, you know, Orthodox Buddhism and stuff like that. But in the end, in most instances, you've always had this kind of elite class telling the peons, eat your gruel. And there's a very simple reason for it. It is that they do want us domesticated. And so what you want in a domestic animal is you want to take the feral, wild nature out of it. You do not want it to resist you. You do not want it to fight back. You don't want it to be violent. And if we're talking about like a cow that, you know, weighs like 1,000 pounds, you don't want a violent cow. As a rancher, I promise you, a violent cow is a problem, because no matter how big Billy Badass you think you are, just, you know, your average garden variety cow, if it wants you dead, can kill you. Plain and simple, right? So when we have domesticated animals, we do want them complacent, compliant, and pacifist. What do we do with a rooster that spurs us in the leg if we're smart? Straight to the death tree. New rooster. Replace them, right? Well, with humans, the number one way you can control their health, their attitude, their ability to stay healthy, their ability to resist, is by controlling their diet. And I would just say that for years and years and years, crazy people like me told you that the reason they were putting fluoride in your water is it lowers IQ and makes you easier to control. And thanks to, excuse me, a well-placed FOIA request, we now know that even the government knew, and this is probably sandbagging a little bit, that fluoride in water while children are developing will reduce their IQ at adulthood by 5 points. 5 points is not an insignificant drop in IQ, especially in a population that already has relatively low IQ. Do you know what the average IQ in America is? 98. That's average. That means there's a lot of people well below 98. I mean, you're not really someone that I believe has a reasonable ability to figure things out until you're at least at like a buck 10. At least. And, you know, we generally consider people who are smart to be in the 120 range. So if you have an IQ population average of 98 and you're knocking 5 points off, you know, you 103 versus 98, there's a difference there in a person's ability to think and get things done. But at the bottom end, like the people that are already going to be, let's just say, not very smart, you know, knock another 5 points off somebody who's an 80 and they're literally retarded. I know I'm not supposed to say that word, but I'm Gen X and we've used that word perfectly acceptably for 20 years of our lives and we're not going to stop now. We never used that word to make fun of people who are actually mentally challenged. We used it to make fun of people who should be able to function and choose not to, right? So, but in the old school before us, they just simply meant mentally impaired, mentally incompetent, right? Was retarded mentally. And the number is 75. So if you got somebody who's going to be an 80 and you fluoride them as a kid, they end up a 75. In any event, if we lower the aggregate average by 5 points, people are easier to control. Now, what we learned when they released the information that's now being used in some places to remove fluoride from the water, which should have never been there in the first place, is that the government knew this. It isn't like some people are reporting it like we just figured this out. So if they would do that for decades, putting a toxic substance in your water, and what other reason would there be to do that other than it controls people? Because I've always said that putting fluoride in water and drinking it to protect your teeth is like drinking suntan lotion to not get a sunburn. It doesn't make sense, and it never will. So I think number one is they don't want a strong, healthy population. It makes us harder to control. Number two, grains are easy to regulate, control, and store. Government has this obsessive need to control everything. Most people that are of upper to mid to upper levels in government, whatever space they're in, they believe that space needs complete regulation. And so that person might not think that everything needs complete regulation, but their vertical needs complete regulation. But the guy in a different area, he thinks his. So when you take the totality across government, government as an entity, not as individuals within it, wants to regulate, control, and quantify everything. They want to know exactly how much there is. How much beef is there on a cow? I mean, there's aggregate average formulas, isn't there? But what cow? In what state? Where? Until that cow is processed, we don't know. But we can get so accurate with estimates with field production that we know exactly how much corn, wheat, soy, et cetera, there'll be every year, and we can manipulate it. We can manipulate it. So if they just decide they want more, they can enact policies that produce more. If they want less of something, they can curtail it. And it's very easy to control. It's very easy to control something when you can quantify it and you can store it long term. So the problem with a cow is the cow walks around, the cow moves. And once you kill the cow, there's a shelf life expectancy on it, right? It's a lot harder to really control a cow. And most people are never going to be able to grow enough wheat or corn or soy to provide for their dietary needs from it. But you can raise a cow in your backyard. Same reason they hate propane. They hate gas. Because gas, I can fill up a 120-pound tank on the side of my house for my grill and my stove, and I don't have to see the guy from the propane place again for over a year. That's inconvenient when you want to control people. I think it's the same reason. I also believe that the vast majority of people making these decisions and these edicts about meat, now not the upper level, I think they know what scum they are, but I'm talking about the people that are instituting policy, coming up with policy, scientists, bureaucrats, all of them. I'm sorry if you don't like what I'm about to say, but I believe they are environmentally and ecologically illiterate, primarily due to climate change religion. This idea that cows are bad for the planet ignores history on this planet of large ruminants that goes back before there were humans. We're talking millions of years of history of this planet, where ruminants have roamed the grasslands, roamed the savannas, roamed the forest, roamed the foothills, and not destroyed the planet. But now all of a sudden, cows are going to destroy the planet. Now, if you already believe in this religion, and then you look at the damage done by raising cattle with a CAFO model, you will get a ton of confirmation bias and perception bias confirmation. Because it is awful. When we take cattle for the last 6 weeks of their lives, and by the time they graduate, they're up to their armpits in their own dung. We have these vast, basically septic systems, these leach fields of nasty manure, and all this. Yes, it is bad. And at the same time, when we have to ship the cow to the CAFO hundreds of miles and then ship the meat from the CAFO hundreds of miles back, that's a problem as well. And we have to ship the grain to the CAFO from hundreds of miles. All of this does increase the environmental footprint of beef production. And here's the thing. There's absolutely no need for it. It's absolutely unnecessary, and it's entirely inefficient. It's less profitable. And the only reason it functions this way is because government regulations have forced it into this model for a combination of reasons. It's not all just they hate you. There's also basic protectionism. It started out meat packers formed unions because they were not treated well. That's how all the unions started. They all started because workers really weren't treated well. But when they grow into a large guild and then they become compromised by the very corporations they think they're fighting, and those corporations realize we can also use the unions, and then you can consolidate down to only a few large meat processors in the country processing all the beef, you get into a very much a controlled organization, and you get to a point where the average person that works there will defend that system to the death because it is their financial death if it goes away. Just like the longshoremen. These longshoremen, what they're terrified of is automation. This longshoreman strike that isn't now, and by the way, I'll tell you who you can thank for that. It's not Kamala Harris. It's not Joe Biden. It's not Donald Trump. It's Ron DeSantis. Ron DeSantis broke that strike within hours of it starting. And this is unrelated to what we're talking about today, at least directly, but I'll tell you how, for those who don't know. DeSantis immediately looked at this. Hurricane had just hit. Another hurricane inbound, and said, nope, this isn't happening in Florida. Activated the Florida National Guard. And said, we will take over the ports until you're done with your strike bullshit, and we will unload the ships because my people are not going to not have supplies because of your bullshit. Now, the problem for the unions with that was what? A whole bunch of other governors, many of them Republicans and willing to do the same thing, went, wait a minute, we could do that shit? I didn't know that. So Abbott was probably on the phone already with like, the commanders of the Texas National Guard. And I'm sure like Brian Kemp in Georgia would have been willing to do that too. Alabama would have done it. So at that point, you would have had Alabama, Florida, Georgia, and Texas open. It would have ruined everything. So now they're magically going to wait until after for whatever fucking reason, right? But my point back to what we were talking about is there is a huge protectionism around this, and it's created a system that just can't work the way that it should. Nobody wants it to go away who is benefiting from it now. So who loses if all of a sudden within 2 hours of my house there's 40 different places that can process beef? Everybody that's near my house wins. All the ranchers win. All the people that produce product win. All the people that want to buy product win. But the large meat packing facilities lose. So you've got the government subsidizing corn, which is being fed through the CAFOs to the beef that's held captive by the conglomerates of the processing system. You see the problem. And this is why we have to at least start in the backyard, though there's some bigger ideas that I have that we'll get to today. And then the last thing you need to know about American beef is the rest of the world thinks it's the best beef in the world. They really do. Now, there's some specialty boutique beef, right? There's some really amazing beef out of certain parts of like Australia and New Zealand. That doesn't come here unless it's going to really high-end restaurants like the Kobe beef out of Japan, etc. But when it comes down to just straight up – you know, Angus grass-fed beef, the European market is almost unlimited for American grass-fed beef. So if you go down to Kroger or Publix or Albertsons or wherever, and you buy like USDA beef off the shelf, and it is not grass-fed, it's conventional beef, it probably was raised in the United States and finished out of CAFO, 99% likely. If you go buy grass-fed beef, unless you know your rancher, you know the supply line, unless they're specifically telling you it's U.S. grass-fed beef, it is probably from New Zealand, Australia, or Brazil. Because almost all the U.S. grass-fed beef that's not sold direct to consumer or maybe on a one-step distribution system instead of a like five, it goes to Europe. And it just goes to Europe because they get more money for it there. It's cheaper for the people in power to import grass-fed beef and sell it into the limited U.S. market for it because we're so consumer-driven that we make everything equivalent. We buy the biggest thing, right? That's how we make decisions in America, with our eyes instead of our brains. And they can make such a profit exporting to Europe and some other parts of the world that that's what they do. So you almost can't buy without taking heroic measures grass-fed beef in the United States that was raised in the United States. Yeah. And somebody says the FDA loses. You're right. Let's talk about why the backyard is the place to start here. Why should we do this? Well, number one is I always bring everything back. All the things that we worry about, we stress about in the world. There's basically three spheres that everything that we are aware of, and then go into one of those spheres. And each sphere is bigger as we go out. Your biggest sphere is your sphere of concern. This is everything you know about that you give a shit remotely about. It could be what they're doing over in Israel in the Middle East right now. It could be whether your football team wins next week, right? Like, and the sex lives of celebrities. It's everything on the TV and the radio. And it's also all things that you absolutely have no control over whatsoever. You have no influence and no control over them. That's a big sphere. It's useful from an informational standpoint. That's what we talk about it some, but it's not where we focus because you literally can't do anything. So it's like the Weather Channel is a valid resource to know if you're going to get hit by a storm, but watching the Weather Channel won't change whether you're going to get hit by a storm or not. You then have to go into what you control to deal with the fact you're going to get hit by the storm. So the next step inside is still a pretty big sphere, is your sphere of influence. And this is the area that you can have some influence over, but you don't really have control. And that would be like, does your family know about issue X? You can tell them. And they actually will probably care that you told them, even if they don't agree, because you're part of their family or your friend's network or whatever. If you're an influencer online, the people that see your tweets or your posts or whatever, that's influence. But in the end, you still don't have any control. That person chooses to act on your advice or information or not. Then you have the smallest sphere, and the sphere that people should spend the absolute most time working on. And it's also the one that people actually spend the least time working on it in. And that's your sphere of control. And those are things that you actually can, you know, you actually can make a decision about. You have 100% ability to control that situation. Hold on a second, guys. I'm trying to get my wife to bring me a glass of water. I got something in the throat going on here that's making this difficult. But anyway, the backyard is about as close as you get to what you can control. And so I think it always makes sense whenever we look at an issue like, well, they want us to eat less meat, and I like meat. I want meat to be the primary nutrient in my diet. It's the most nutrient-dense food in the world, and I don't want to give it up. So what is the thing that I can most do? And it is probably looking into your backyard. And understand, when I say backyard, I don't just mean your literal yard. It could be your garage with something like rabbits or quail. What I just mean is on your property, the property that you can control. It also can be very productive. You know, I think a lot of people are like, I wish I had enough room to do sheep. Okay. I understand. Delicious meat. I was just up at John Willis's and for Silver Lions Festival. And he had it like an extra ram. Like when he got some sheep, they were supposed to be a certain amount of ewes and a certain amount of rams or whatever. I don't know how that worked out. I guess he didn't check under the hood. And it turned out that he had an extra ram. And so since they had the festival going on and all, and since Backwoods Butcher was there, he's like, butcher this ram. So this is a mature ram. This is not a lamb. This is a mature adult ram who was living on sweet feed based on the amount of fat on this animal. So they put it down, string it up, skin it. He showed you how to break it all down. And I took about half of it home. They were like, anybody that wants it can have it. I had a plug-in freezer cooler, the ones that plug into your car. I'll take it. So I brought it home. I brought about 20 pounds home. So that adult animal, when completely processed down. Now, this didn't include, like, the organ meat and stuff like that. About 20 pounds. So that means about 40 pounds of meat on the animal. Okay, great. So a rabbit, well grown out, 4 to 5 pounds. So 8 to 10 rabbits equals one sheep. It's not even a effort to have like a trio, like let's say two does and one buck rabbit, and outproduce that. Like that's, you know, you could outproduce, you know, harvesting two sheep a year pretty easily. Now, I don't think the meat's as good, but it's good quality meat for sure. So my point is it can be very, very productive. And I'll save some thoughts on the productivity when we go through some of the animals here in a minute. Next, we have proven blueprints for what to do. There's not a small-scale livestock, like backyard-level livestock, let's say sheep, pigs, goats, and down, that we don't have, you know, 10 different ways to do all of them. Whether it's chicken tractoring or coop and run for chickens, or the same thing with ducks, or stack systems with quail, or aviary systems with quail. My point is we know what to do. Even some stuff I'm not going to cover today, I can give you five different ways to raise pigeons. Five different ways to raise pigeons. And pigeons are a great meat and egg source as well. And they'll go out and forage for themselves. So my point is that it's not like we have to figure out how to do this. We already know how to do this. There's already tons of information, hundreds, thousands of years of human history of us doing this. We know how to raise animals for meat in our backyard on small scale. And it puts you in touch with the reality of where your food comes from. There are vegans who I find to be the most obnoxious people on planet Earth. And there are vegans that I find to be, I don't agree with their choice from a nutritional standpoint, and I never will, but I agree with a lot of the points that they make. They're considerate, well thought out people. And they say things like, if the average person had to produce their own meat, they wouldn't eat any. I don't think that's necessarily wrong. I think if you have to produce your own meat and you have to take a life, it is something serious. It's not something that I enjoy doing. When I cull birds or something like that, I'm never really excited about it. I get over it pretty quick. I look at slaughter and processing as two separate actions. So slaughter first, process second. I actually enjoy processing meat. But I think there is something to being connected to it. And I think it makes you a better person if you're in touch with it. And the reason is I think that grateful people become better people. The more appreciative you are of things in general, of people, of actions, of opportunity, the more you know, I think one of the reasons that religion has such a positive impact on people is it teaches you to be grateful for what you have. You know, say grace before eating, I think is a very healthy thing for someone to do, even if you're not really a religious person. To simply be grateful, to look at the situation in front of you and say, I'm grateful for this that I'm about to receive. And I think when you're in connection to something gave its life so that I could have mine, I think there's a huge value to that. And I also think it makes you aware of how precarious human nature is. Like, I think if you get into the mindset of meat comes from the store, if I'm out of meat, I'll just go get more. If food comes from the store and I'm out of food, I'll just go get more. As we've seen, it doesn't always work that way. So those are my reasons for the backyard. What's your best bet? I'm going to start off combining chickens and ducks. And I guess I would put geese in this, except they just don't lay eggs sufficiently to really be an equivalent. Like, geese lay eggs 60 days a year. You'll get 40 to 50 eggs from a goose. And, you know, unless you have a lot of geese and you store your eggs some way, it's nothing like having those fresh eggs throughout most of the year from geese or from ducks or chickens. I'm also going to say, just real quick here, I'm going to cover 7 options. It's not all of them. I'm not talking about, you know, turkeys today, for instance. I think turkeys are a great backyard meat source. I'm not going to talk about guinea pigs, and I'm sure that will come up from somebody in the live chat, you know, cooey. There's pigeons, like I mentioned. Not going to cover that today. I'm going to cover the basic stuff that there's plenty of information for, that's easy to acquire and easy to take care of, and we'll have the biggest bang for the buck for the backyard, the small acreage producer. So chickens and ducks, I think the main product there is eggs. It really is, because unless you're doing like dedicated meat birds or something like that, it's generally the driving thing that makes people acquire these animals. They're also great in function stacking for compost and all, but we're not going into that today. I would say that between the two of them, I have a personal, you know, affection for ducks. I think that they make a better quality egg. It's more nutrient dense. It tastes better. But from an ease of management, chickens are probably the best bet for the most people. And you can produce meat from your chickens. And the best way I know to do it, if you're not going to buy like some dedicated meat birds like once a year or twice a year and do a cycle, if you want to be self-sufficient, is pick a large breed chicken and get a large breed rooster that's not the same breed. So an example, I have Jersey Giants, and I do have a rooster because somebody at the Jersey Giant chicken factory didn't check under the hood right and thought he was a hen. That happens. But when I didn't think I had a rooster and I was looking to get a rooster, I was looking for like a Brahma or a Buff Orpington. And the reason is, when you make that initial F1 cross, you get something called hybrid vigor. And it's really easy to do because you just, you know, depending on the size of your flock, you have one rooster or two roosters if you have enough girls. And you just have one breed of rooster and one breed of hen. And despite what some of the wokes say, that's going to control the breeding really, really well. And you could even start working with other people in your area who breed specific chicken breeds. So every once in a while, you can bring in some new genetics on either side. Definitely coop and run is probably the easiest thing for most people to do. Is it my favorite way to do it? No. Is it the easiest way for most people to do it? Probably. Especially like a coop and double run or a movable coop and run. It's kind of like a tractor with a coop attached to it. The next would be tractoring, but you know, that is daily work. My preferred method is free range. Free range or small paddock. Moving on, quail. I personally think quail is the best animal for the most people to get started producing protein at home. And if you have a question, do it exactly like Kurt did here. Question first and all caps, and then your question. That's the only question I have right now. Start. but the beauty of quail is you get protein from a meat standpoint and protein from an egg standpoint, much like chickens, except it is way easier to be self-sufficient. Way, way easier to be self-sufficient. And here's why. First of all, a quail goes from an egg to a baby quail in 18 days. And 6 weeks after that, that bird is more than big enough to process. And 7 weeks, it's probably at a point where if you're going to process it, if you're not going to grow it out as a new layer, you probably should process it. It's going to start to get tough, and it's not really going to gain any more size. So 6 to 7 weeks you have meat after hatch. 18 days after eggs laid and put in an incubator, you have another round of babies. They can be kept in stacked cage systems. Again, this is not my preferred method, but I wouldn't fault anybody for doing it, especially as they're learning how. And like Brad Davies, Moon Valley Prepper, we had him on the show years and years ago. He was producing, you know, a couple thousand meat birds and like 20,000 eggs a year in a one-car garage with like a three-stack system. That's more than most people will ever want to do or ever need to do. But if you look at it this way, a quail will generally, during their laying cycle, like give you one egg a day, 28 days a month. That's what they'll do. If you play with lighting and all, sometimes you can actually get them to double throw. In other words, they'll lay two eggs in one day. But let's just go on. You're going to get, let's just even go on, you're going to get 20 eggs per girl per month. Okay? 10 girls is 200 eggs. Three of them will equal about one large chicken egg. It's about three good-sized Cornix quail eggs to a chicken egg. So you got plenty of eggs there for your family. If you want to hatch, how many? If you have a family of four, let's say you're going to eat quail one day a week, two birds per person, eight birds. That's eight eggs. A couple roos and a few cages full of hens, and you can't not make enough food. And they're very effective on feed utilization. We'll talk about feeding and how to cut the feed bill and feed store dependence later in the show. But to me, they're just beautiful from that respect. The other side of it, the beauty of quail is the ease of processing. And it is literally pop the wings off, pop the breast out, pop the leg quarters out, done. Now, if you want to pluck them and keep the skin on them, they're delicious that way and everything. But from a day-to-day standpoint, being able to, with no tools at all, process your quail is fantastic from a standpoint of actually using the meat and being, you know, able to process on your own and not needing anybody to help you. And the other thing I would say, though, is what I just said is true of your dedicated meat birds. The beauty of quail is also that you can reproduce. You can keep your breeding stock well, your laying numbers up all on your own by hatching new birds. And you're going to get about 18 months from a quail before it goes into its first molt. When it goes into its first molt, it is not going to lay eggs for about 4 to 5 weeks. This is when you want to actually harvest those culls, because those females, when they come out of that molt, they will start laying again. They will never lay at the volume they do in their first cycle. And so this is the time. So what you can, because this is all math, you can figure out these birds that hatched on this date will be ready for processing on this date. I'll take X number of females out of that group, band them so I know which group they're part of, and they'll start laying at 6 to 7 weeks. I'm going to take, you know, all the males except maybe any new males I need, and all my surplus females at that point, and I'm going to process them. And then I know that that group is going to hit the molt. I mean, you could get it almost to the day. And so what I'll do is count back about 6 to 7 weeks from that day, and I know that I need to put a large number of eggs in the incubator sufficient to replace that group with that next hatch. And so those birds will have, you know, I'm going to go 6 weeks back and then another 18 days. And that's when they go in the incubator. I'm going to put them in the incubator. And that means by the time I'm culling, I already have new layers and I already have new males. But those birds that you're culling that are 18 months old, they are a lot tougher. You can do it with your hands alone. It's not as easy. Just a pair of good shears. Cut the backbone out. I'm not going to get into how to do it, but they're just fantastic from a standpoint of eggs and meat and ease of processing and ease of breeding, ease of incubation, ease of getting very, very self-sufficient with them. And again, if you just raise enough that you can have one meal a week of quail, you've gone a long way toward taking your protein sovereignty back. Next up, let's talk about rabbits. The reason I love rabbits, even though I don't raise them, and I only don't raise them for one reason, and that's my wife won't eat them. And I just, I can't put the time and effort into raising an animal that only I will eat. And so I don't do that with them. But I would if she would even freaking try it, honestly. And what I love about rabbits the most is they are the easiest of all backyard livestock to become completely feed independent with. You know, with a good grass and forbs mixture in your lawn, a bagging lawnmower, a mini hay baler that you can make for about $25 by looking up how to do it on YouTube with some parts. Well, now that prices are higher, let's say $40-$50 worth of material to build one. And a few fodder trees. I would still have rabbit pellets as like a backup. But you can produce rabbits for pretty much free if you have that. And so anybody can have that. Anybody can do that. Everybody has enough room. Almost anywhere you live. I'm not going to say anywhere you live, but almost anywhere you live, there's a rabbit breed or cross that will adapt to your climate. And you can learn how to do this and you can have an abundance of meat. People talk about the fur and all. Most people I know that do rabbits, they like the idea of it. It's a pain in the ass to skin them to where the hides really are usable. They're only worth so much, so they talk about it, but they don't do it. And I don't care. To me, with a rabbit, when I process a rabbit, I have the meat for me. I have the waste product for the dog. I have the fertility for the garden. It's just fantastic. And the amount of meat that can be produced with a trio or a quartet, basically three females and a buck, is insane. There is no reason a family couldn't eat a rabbit meal a week easily, with a meal being two bunnies all year round, that was managing a group of, let's say, four, a buck and three does. And if we did rabbits and quail that way, that's two out of 7 days right there. And that's with no extra production that we could do. And if we add in the eggs and the meals those provide, it starts to stack up really, really quick. Pigs is one of my next recommendations. Now, not everybody can do pigs. It's not as universal as the first three that we've done, or four really, chickens, ducks, rabbits, and quail. They're a larger animal. They can stink. They do require management at a different level. I'm only going to talk about them so much today because my special guest tomorrow is actually coming on to talk about backyard pork on that smaller scale. So I'm going to leave it off that. But what I'm going to tell you is that they are about the most efficient feed conversion animal that we have. Most of our typical domestic breed pigs. Now, there's some that are smaller, that are more like an 18-month cycle, like American Guinea hogs and things like that. But when you look at what people will refer to as pink pigs, even though they're not all pink, you're looking at about 7 to 8 months and you get a pig to a size that it's reasonable to harvest versus cattle where you're looking at like 18 to 24 months or even sometimes more. Sometimes it's not that you couldn't harvest that cow at 18 months, but 20 to 24 months, it would just be so much higher value in a properly managed grass-fed cattle situation. So they're quick turnaround, large amounts of meat, pretty easy to manage once you set up a system. And there's a long history of us using pigs this way in smaller scale situations. In World War II in England, out on the farms, you would have thought that they would have had like abundance of food. And they definitely did better than people in the cities. But a lot of the food that were being produced by farms in England during World War II, the farmers didn't have the food stolen from them. It was purchased. It was sold into the market, but they had to sell it into the market because there was rationing and there were food shortages throughout all of the United Kingdom. So they were told, like, you have to produce X amount. And if they didn't produce enough food, they literally could have their farm taken and given to another farmer that the government felt would make full use of the land. I mean, that's how serious this was. And in this, the most valuable thing was fat. And the next most valuable thing was meat in people's minds, because they would leave you alone with your little vegetable garden and stuff like that. Like, if that, you had your little vegetable and herb garden out and your fruit trees along your field rows and all, the farm people and the country people kept all that shit. But they had to harvest X amount of grain, X amount of pea, and whatever, in from the field. And when they grew livestock, that had to be sold. It was very regimented what portion had to be sold. And so they made an allowance for something called pig clubs. And the way a pig club would work is, instead of, like, you know, we talk about, you know, farming pigs, where we have them like out being pasture raised and all, that's the best way to go. Well, it would be your typical pigsty. So you had your pigsty, the pig lived in. And it would live at one person's farm. But maybe like two or three or four farms would go in together on the pig club. And they would all save all of their waste product, like their garden vegetables and all, and it would all be boiled into a slop. And that would be fed to the pig. And then at the end of that growth cycle, you know, toward like your holiday season, okay, it's time for Miss Piggy to graduate. And Miss Piggy would go to the butcher, and half the pig would get sold into the market, and then the people that had the pig club together would split the other half of the pig. Now, they were doing this, you know, with confinement areas that are about the size of my studio office. Do I think that's the best way for a pig to live? I really don't. But I also have seen pigs live that way, and if you're not like stacking like 80 pigs in there, they don't seem too unhappy to me, especially if they've never experienced anything different. And that's something I've noticed about chickens. You take chickens from the time they're baby chicks, and you manage them and grow them and raise them in a chicken tractor scenario, they're happy as shit. You take a chicken that's had experience as a free-range bird, you put it in a tractor, it is a miserable animal. And you can understand why. So just keep that in mind. But I'll just say pigs can be done in relatively small amounts of land. You might be far more dependent on an external feed source that way, but it can be done. And again, we'll talk about some ways to be more food independent. Sheep and goats, I'm going to have as two separate animals, but I'm going to combine them for the sake of the length of this podcast. The primary difference between sheep and goats is that goats will browse more and be more likely to make your life miserable with escape capabilities. A goat is more likely to get on top of your car or the roof of your house or walk sapling trees down to the ground and eat everything off of them. As you can tell, I don't have a fondness in my heart for goats. I have a very big fondness in my heart for a goat that's already dead and hanging from a hook that I'm going to cut up into pieces and eat. I love to eat goats. I don't have any problem processing a goat. I just don't want to take care of them. Sheep are much easier to deal with. They are less able to escape. And a lot of the hair sheep is what they'll call them, meaning you don't have to shear them. And that's what I would recommend. Your St. Croix, your Dorpers, etc. They actually browse fairly well, too. So they have a greater ability to utilize vegetation that your more conventional sheep can't. And so either way, I'd go there. Now, if you're going to do goats, I mean, what you need is goat terrorism. That's how you maintain goats. You put electric fencing where the goats are going to be inside, and you need a electric fence controller that makes you afraid, deathly afraid of the fence. Like, you don't want to touch it. And if you do touch it, you wish you did. So that if that goat touches that fence one time, that goat is just literally terrified of that fence. And if you do that and you maintain everything and you keep that fence hot enough, you probably won't find goats on the roof of your house or the hood of your car. Probably. Not guaranteed. Probably. Because it still happens. And if you run that fence hot enough, you're not going to get, you know, people talk about the vegetation growing up on the fence and shorting it out. And I learned this from Greg Judy, who's doing it with sheep. If you keep that fence hot enough power on that fence, as that vegetation begins to touch that fence, it will basically shock the vegetation to death and prevent it from actually growing up into the fence. So that's a little hack there. Fish would be my last one for you today. You guys know I love raising fish. I raise fish in my backyard. My three primary species I raise are bluegill and all sunfish, right? Like all the in Texas, they call them perch. I know they're not perch. I grew up in Pennsylvania. We ate yellow perch all the time. It's what they fucking call them. Get over it. In Florida, they call them brim. In Pennsylvania, they call them sunnies. Whatever they call them where you are, sunfish, bluegills, perch. And then I do bullhead catfish, and I do channel catfish. And I do those because they're all local. I can procure them locally. I catch them. I bring them home. But I do them in relatively small garden ponds, you know, somewhere between 1,100 gallons and about 5,000 gallons. If you live somewhere that you can put in like a quarter acre or larger pond, it is the easy button. If you can put in a pond big enough that it doesn't need aeration, it is the easy button. And you can literally, you can get either a dedicated fish feeder, but I found that deer feeders are so cheap because they make so many more of them. You just take a deer feeder and a little bit of sheet metal and build a deflector on it, set a deer feeder up on the side of your pond, set the timer, don't overfeed. But then you can throw fish pellets into that pond every evening, and you can vastly accelerate the growth rate of those fish. And the beauty of that is you can harvest when you need to only. So instead, like if we kill more rabbits than we want to eat today, they got to go in the freezer. We kill chickens, they got to go in the freezer. Yeah, we can go out and harvest one or two, but you know, the work involved in processing animals like that, plus the fact that there's a optimal age other than culls to process. So we do like a run of chickens. If we have 20 chickens, I'm processing all 20 chickens on the same day. That's quite a bit of space in the freezer. If I have a pond with fish that are pellet feed trained, and I want a catfish for tacos tonight, all I got to do is go out there about the time that that feeder is going to go off with a rod, reel, and a hook, and something for bait, and I'm pulling a fish out in 5 seconds. Plus, I get the fun and the recreational component of it as well. So I can leave that meat on the fin until I want to harvest it. And that is an extreme value right there to me. Because if the power goes out, I'm not worried about the freezer defrosting when it comes to my fish supply. And if I need something tonight, I can go. It's actually in some ways more convenient than the freezer. Tell me you've never, especially you married types, you've never had this conversation before. Hey, honey, what did you take out to eat tonight? Nothing. I thought you took something out. And it's 5 o'clock and it's almost dinner time and everything's frozen. It's not the end of the world. You figure out something to do, but we've all had that. If I have a pond full of fish, I guess we're eating fish tonight. And I can have that fish out of the water, fillet knife through it in a matter of minutes. And this is something about fish that's not really true about most everything else we talked about. If I process something like even a chicken, I really don't want to cook that animal immediately. I want to let it pass through rigor. I want some age on the meat. Refrigerator overnight, at least. If I'm processing something like a sheep or a goat or a cow or a pig, I want more age on that meat. I actually want to quarter it and throw it in like a dedicated refrigerator and let it age for a few days before I finish processing it. Everything just comes out better. It's more tender. A fish? There's no better time to cook a fish than about 10 seconds after the fillet comes off the bone or however you processed it. So you have that going for you. Now let's talk about feed, because one of the problems we have as we go to this is that we become dependent on outside inputs. And I don't hate that, but I don't like being 100% dependent on it. Like this morning, when I did the duck ponds, because my grandson is with his aunt and uncle who are in town this week, so he's not here to do his job, so I have to do his job in the mornings. And so I go out, I fill the duck tubs up. I went behind the duck coop, and I pulled a bunch of water hyacinth out and some azolla out, and when I filled their tubs up, then I filled the tubs, floated a bunch of this vegetation. That cuts the feed bill that day, and we'll talk more about that in a minute. But I don't want to be 100% dependent on a feed store. So what are our options for that? One is fodder trees, which Nick Ferguson has made very well known in this community and audience. And if you if you want like a ongoing, almost forever source of feed, your fodder trees are the way to go. And the beauty of those is they can be kind of planted around your perimeter or a little stand over here. And it doesn't take very much. Gamer time, I don't know what C is, so you're going to have to complete the rest of that question. What's my opinions on C? Give me the rest of that one, and we'll get it queued up for you. But, you know, poplar, willow, and mulberry are your primary ways to go there. And just by pruning at the right time and taking the fodder and, you know, like your number one animal that we talked about today that most people can do is rabbits. A little bit of a fodder goes a long way with a couple hutches of rabbits. Your sheep and goats and pigs will work pretty well with it as well. Chickens and ducks, quail, I haven't seen them have much interest in it. I thought it would become a big thing with geese, with fodder. And the reason was when we raised this last group of pilgrim geese as babies, I was trying all kinds of different fodder trees for them to see if they would eat it, and they would eat it right out of our hands. sorry. And they ate everything we offered them. We have a lot of weeping willow. They ate that. We have a lot of different mulberry species. They ate every mulberry I put in front of them. Hackberry. They ate every piece of hackberry I put in front of them. So I expected to see these geese as we let them out of their tractor and let them free range, eating the lower growing parts of these trees. And they just quit. So I don't know what their deal is, but like now if I take a piece of lettuce and I go offer it to them, they'll come up and they're a little skitsy, but they'll eat it out of my hand. But if I offer them a piece of hackberry or mulberry, they don't want it. I have never seen that be much of a problem when it comes to, like, you know, goats and rabbits and stuff. Like they just eat the hell out of it. So I think it's one of the better options that you can implement is fodder trees. Next would be rabbit gardens. And when I say rabbit garden, I don't really mean rabbit garden. It's just, I just like the sound of the rabbit garden, right? I mean, you can just grow food in a garden for your animals instead of for yourself. And this is something we're looking at more and more because we're getting to where, like, pretty much I use a few cucumbers a year. It's probably not worth growing them for the amount that I use. We use some eggplant every year. We use a lot of peppers and a few tomatoes and a lot of herbs. And we eat so little vegetables and like we'll eat like a lot of herbs and lettuces and stuff like that. But other than that, man, my garden space has mostly been flowers this year, which has been great because it's brought so many pollinators and predators in. But we could be growing, you know, I don't have rabbits, so I wouldn't have a rabbit garden, but we could be growing like black oil sunflower. We could be growing sorghum. We do grow wheat and rye every year as cover crops, and we could let some of the beds mature. And all of that can be fed to our poultry. And so you can start looking at if you're going to be a heavy meat eater and a light plant-based diet person, well, then instead of, you know, not gardening, you can basically garden for your livestock. And there's a lot of options there, and I've done full shows on it. Then somebody mentioned, I assume this is what they were talking about. I think they said BFS, and I think they meant BSF or BSL, Black Soldier Fly Larva. These are probably one of the easiest things in the world to grow that people have made way, 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 way complicated. So there's these really expensive bins that have this very specific angle of ledge that the Black Soldier Fly self-harvest in, but a big Rubbermaid tub with a piece of plywood that kind of funnels to a hole will do the same thing. You can buy seed stock, but in my experience, you don't need them. Every time I've set up any kind of compost environment that is not like a bioreactor compost that ends up with BSL in it. I've had worm farms invaded by BSL that were inside shop buildings that they had to get in there, then get into the worm farm and basically took the whole damn thing over. So they will show up. The thing that I have found that inevitably will make them show up is dog kibble that's been soaked for like a day and then let start stinking. And then you can put any waste stream in there that they'll consume, which is most waste streams. And this includes, you know, things like meats and guts and stuff like that. So if you're regularly processing fish, for instance, you can throw all the waste in there and they will devour it. The bones will look like a Tom and Jerry commercial or something when they're done with it. And they will produce a waste that is fantastic as a fertilizer, especially if you also vermicompost. This is kind of the secret sauce to make like the best vermicompost and best fat black soldier fly compost at the same time. Run both and take your frost, which is your waste, your maggot poop from your back soldier flies, and put that into worm farms and let it process a second time. And that has had great results. But from a feed standpoint, high fat, high protein feed for anything that'll eat a bug. So ducks, chickens, quail will all eat them, and your fish will eat them as well. They also freeze well, and they dehydrate well. So when they harvest themselves, what they do is they pupate, and before they completely go into pupa mode, they crawl out of the garbage they're in, right, the dead animal, whatever it is they're in, and they go down in the soil. They don't want to be in the waste because literally the other ones that are still awake will eat them. That's why they crawl out, right? So we can use that to make them self-harvest. Well, once they self-harvest, it's not very long before they go into this dormant pupa state. And so you can have something like a coffee can or something that catches them. Once they're in that state, you can throw them on a sheet, throw them in the freezer and freeze them. You can also just throw them on a tray and put them in like an Excalibur dehydrator. And they'll die and they'll dehydrate and they'll last damn near forever at that standpoint. I've heard of people freeze drying them. Freeze drying is an expensive process and it's not necessary for these things. I would just dehydrate them. And they could be, you don't even need a dehydrator. They could be dehydrated like in the sun. Because once they go into that dormant state, if you set them out in the sun, they're not going to wake up and crawl away. But a dehydrator works really, really well for that. All right, next up, let's talk about water plants that I mentioned earlier. Azolla is one of the best. And another really great one is water hyacinth. And duckweed works well as well too, but it's very small form. And the two I've had the best results with pretty much everything I offer it to eating it is water hyacinth and azolla. So let's talk about both of them. Water hyacinth, pretty much everything that we eat, eats it. And it's very high in protein. By dry weight, it's something like 35% protein. So it's an incredibly valuable feedstock. Now, the thing is, dry weight, it shrinks a lot. I filled up about a 2-foot round, 3-foot high wire frame completely to the top with water hyacinth just to see and let it fully dry, and it ended up being about 4 inches deep at the bottom of it. So it's a major reduction. But it is high protein, and they really like it. I generally feed the water hyacinth to my ducks two ways. One is in a pit that's part of my composting process, and they eat it okay there. Where they eat it like crazy is in their water tubs. They're water birds. They like their food in the water. You throw that in, and I throw, you know, like a big bucket. I threw about 10 gallons by volume into their tubs today. I guarantee if I go out there right now, there's barely any left. They've completely knocked it out. The chickens like it in the compost pit. Geese and ducks, and I imagine other waterfowl, Muscovy ducks, what have you, eat the roots and the plant. Everything else, they just stop right at the roots. They won't touch. The chickens don't eat the roots. The ducks love to go through the roots, though, because there's snails and stuff in there. So now they're getting snails and little shrimp and things like that out of the aquatic systems with it as well. Azolla will double its size roughly every 48 to 72 hours under optimal conditions. In my experience, optimal conditions are when it's really hot out, a dappled shade, and when it starts to get cooler, but it's not freezing or anything yet, like right now, in the south anyway, would be full sun. And I have it in systems that are all common, in like, you know, multiple tanks, one system. It's all the same water circulating, same nutrient level, everything. And over here in one tank, it's explosive. It's 2 inches thick as a mat. And then over here, there's none because it died because it was too intense of sunlight. And now those areas that didn't have any in the summer are starting to grow it because there's a little bit that survived or flows through, or I'll reseed it. It's another one of those things. Almost everything we eat eats azolla. It's also in the 30 percentile by dry weight for protein, so it's extremely valuable. It doesn't need a lot of nutrient. One thing about water hyacinth. Water hyacinth works best in high-nutrient water systems. It's why it's actually used as a filtration plant in commercial duck operations, where the duck waste goes into like a lagoon. The lagoon is full of water hyacinth, and the water that comes out the other end of the lagoon is cleaner when it comes out the other end of the lagoon than when it goes into the duck from a drinking system. It's that good at pulling nutrient out. But it means that the water hyacinth needs nutrient. Is all for all the taking over the world. One, it doesn't survive a freeze at all. And two, if you go to, like, if it takes the nutrient out of the water, it starts to die almost immediately. So any of my ponds, when the fish population gets low, I have to do a major water change, something like that. If I don't add nutrient to it, then it starts to turn yellow and not produce. Azolla, totally different, is a nitrogen-fixing fern, so it doesn't need nitrogen at all. It will take it from the water, but it will fix it to its root. So we can also use it as a source of fertilizer as well as a feed. And those are my two number one water plants. They also will feed fish. The water hyacinth won't. I've never seen anything eat water hyacinth as a fish. But any of the places that I have goldfish or koi or tilapia, I don't have azolla. And as soon as you put azolla in it, in a day or two, it's gone because the fish eat it. So any kind of vegetable-eating fish will tend to eat azolla. So like in one of my ponds, what I've done, I have like a fish kindergarten. It's a 100-gallon Rubbermaid stock tank with a bunch of half-inch holes drilled in it. So like the minnows and baby fish can get in and out, but the big fish can't. And I have that inside there. It's covered in azolla. And then the rest of the pond has like big koi in it, big catfish in it, big goldfish in it. And what I'll do is when I go out there, I'll just take like two handfuls out of the one tank and just toss it into the main tank. And that way I have a constant supply there. And there's other ways to feed fish that I won't get into today, like higher level tanks that have freshwater shrimp in them. And the shrimp wash down and they get eaten by the panfish and what have you. next is either tractoring or like small paddock pasture rotation. The fact that my birds, for instance, are free range, I feed them way less than is recommended. So here's an example of how much less. The recommended commercial feed ratio for egg-laying ducks, which are relatively small birds, so you're talking like 300 layers, khaki Campbells, Pekins, dedicated egg-laying birds, which have high feed conversion ratio, is 0.4 pounds to the bird to the day. So, you know, you can do the math from there of how much you'll need every month in pelletized feed for however many ducks you have. For meat breeds like jumbo Pekins and silver apple yards, the recommendation is 0.5 to 0.6 pounds. Now, I have mixed flocks where I have, you know, more large breed and small breed and what have you, and runners and all. I feed 0.25 pounds of feed per day. Now, I don't weigh it every day and all, but I've kind of figured out it's, you know, this high on a 5-gallon bucket is how much feed that they need. And most of the time, there's some feed left the next morning. So they're not even using it all. So it's between the stuff that we're feeding them and the free ranging. If you have a big enough piece of land, paddocks are beautiful. If you can set up even like a wagon wheel coming out of a coop, or out of a holding area for ruminants or what have you, or a laneway-based system. It's the best way to go if you have animals that can make a living on pasture. Pigs, goats, sheep, if you're bigger, cattle. Because it's the way nature does it. And by controlling them and moving them through the system, we've done whole shows on that, but you get a much better conversion ratio. and then tie into other people's waste streams. I call this the Billy Bond method. Billy raises chickens essentially for free, and I think his number on pork is 39 cents a pound. This is what he figured out from, and I'm not even sure where the cost is. Maybe he's factoring all the gas to all the waste stream that he's bringing back and saying, I'll just put it all to the pigs and just say the chickens are free. So what he's doing is he'll find like a restaurant or a school cafeteria or what have you, and he'll take all their waste and he'll feed it to his pigs and his chickens. Now, let me tell you what you never say if you want to be successful at getting a hold of this material. You never tell them, I'm going to feed it to my livestock. You say, I am going to make compost. That's what Billy tells them. I'm going to make compost. I'm trying to help the earth. I'm trying to get rid of carbon, trying to save the planet by making compost out of your garbage and keeping it out of the landfill. And he can get more than he can use by doing that. So if you can find places, you know, I've heard people get tons of like pulp from like Jamba Juice outlets, things like that. Well, now, geez, now we can feed that to our animals. We also have other options. If the product that I can get a hold of maybe isn't the best to feed directly to animals. Yeah, that's true. I'm gonna star that. Hey, hey, Alabama. We'll talk about that later. But I'm sorry. I lost what I was thinking of there. So anyway, you find a waste stream, and it's not the best waste stream to feed your animals. Let's say you find a coffee shop, and they'll give you all the coffee grinds, and you're like, but you know, I really can't feed my rabbits coffee grinds. Yeah, and you probably can't do what I'm about to say for your rabbits either. But your chickens and your ducks will root through coffee grinds into the compost system and help incorporate it. Trust me, I know. But you know what eats the hell out of coffee grinds? Black soldier fly larva. You can raise them almost exclusively on coffee grinds. And one coffee shop will keep you supplied. You won't run out. You'll have tons of feed for your black soldier flies. So now we could take something like our ducks and our chickens. We could raise the black soldier flies on the waste stream and then feed the black soldier flies to the chickens and the ducks or the quail or what have you. And that is awesome in what that enables you to do. Then let's talk about a few other options that I just want to kind of mention here toward the end. One is co-ops and food clubs and stuff like that, but maybe on another level. I've often thought, and maybe this is something that, you know, you're talking about some people with some money get started. And maybe eventually it even kind of becomes a business for them, and then that helps people that are willing to buy, but they don't have enough money to be part of the start. Now, here's what I mean by that. It's very difficult to get your animals processed, especially in some states. It's not that hard here, but there's a lot of restrictions on it. But if you own your own property and you own your own animals, you can pretty much do anything you want. What if like 10 people got together, threw in the seed money, put in a processing facility? I'm not even saying it has to be inspectable by the state. I mean just all the shit you need to do a good job processing cattle. And then you hire someone to manage the herd. And you have a little co-op, a little beef co-op. And you buy or lease land, and you throw your 10 head on there. And every year you're processing your cattle. Maybe you're running cow-calf pairs or something like that. You got a bull or two so that you can be self-sufficient on reproduction, what have you. Well, once you got that established, you could probably do like fractional herd shares where maybe then we can have, what's our carrying capacity? Let's say that all the people that go in on it want 10 beef a year, whether it's a half, a whole, a quarter, whatever it is. Like in the end, all the founders want 10, but you have a carrying capacity of 20. I don't see any reason under, you know, most states anyway, law, that you couldn't say like a quarter of this cow is Bill's and a quarter of this cow is Tom's, and a quarter of this cow is Dana's, and a quarter of this cow is Chrissy's. And then they all gets processed, and you have employees like any other co-op. And then if we can tie into kind of the food club model and things like that, private member associations and all, I think we can completely radically transform this whole space. That's probably a whole different thing. And I'm going to have Alan Booker come on pretty soon and talk about the work he's doing to get into a model like that at a level that's never been done before. I mean, I spent a lot of time with Alan at Self-Reliance Festival. I knew he was a genius at plant genetics. I've always respected his work. I did not know he was one of us the way he is. And what I mean is freedom and liberty oriented, food sovereignty oriented. Like, he is an amazing man, and he's putting together a program that I think is going to make this very modular and expandable. So I just wanted to kind of prime the pump for that today. Next, local beef producers who deliver to a processor for you. That's what I do. So there's a guy, he's three houses up the road from me. He raises, you know, not a lot. He probably raises about 30 head a year. And he sells all direct. He doesn't sell anything through, like, the multi-tiered market, sale barn, none of that shit. He raises his cattle. When they're ready to go, he calls all his people that have bought before, and you get first crack before he goes outside the group, so to say. And, you know, he'll contact me, you want to buy a beef this year. And as long as it's not like, if he does it right now, I'm like, damn it, can you wait? Because I don't have freezer space right now leading up to a workshop. But I'll say, like, I need, he'll pair me up with somebody. I'll never even know who that person is. And he takes the cattle down to the processor. Processor slaughters them and hangs them. Lets them hang for about 10 days. And about that point, I'll get a call from the processor. And I will basically go through the cut sheet with the processor. This is what I want, the ossobuscos out of the, you know, the shanks or whatever. I want ribeyes. How thick do you want? I want my ribeyes 1 inch thick. I want my strip loins 1 inch thick. I want X percentage of my hamburger fine ground and X percent chili ground. I want, you know, different things, different ways. And then they'll call me, you know, about another week, say, come get your shit. And I'll go get four huge boxes I can barely pick up and bring home and squirrel them away in my freezer. And that, people say, you know, like, that's got to be more expensive. No, it's not. It is so much less expensive than going to the store. All in, I've got about $5 a pound across, you know, all the different types of meats and cuts from a cow that was raised a mile and a half away from, not even a mile and a half, like a mile away from me. And to me, that's just a better deal all around. And then, you know, I've done a couple of shows on this, but learn to break down primals that you can buy right out of the typical supply chain. You know, learn to go out, go to Costco or whatever and say, I want to buy a whole chuck roll. And they'll sell you one. And you'll pay a fraction of what you'd pay for it all to be cut up. And learn to, like, break out the Denver steak, break out the Chuck Guy steak, break out the basically the false short ribs, and do your own grind and all of that stuff. It's really the easy button to eat more beef for less money is learning how to do basic meat cutting. So if you want to go to the survivalpodcast.com and put in the search box, butcher your budget. And I have a whole show that I go through all the ways to break down these primals. And I have a second episode of that that goes more into other things like pork cuts and things like that as well. And I think it's just a fantastic way to cut the budget. And what people will say is, well, you're buying CAFO beef or you're buying factory beef or whatever. Okay. But if that's what you're buying anyway, what's the difference? If that's what you're buying, what, do you feel better by paying more for the same product? And I would tell you that I would rather a person eat, you know, USDA beef and pork out of the supermarkets than live on the food the average American is living on, which, you know, a grain-based diet. Like, they always say, like, it's a plant-based diet, but it's a grain-based diet. Grain and legumes are where most – and tubers are where most people are deriving their calories from today. And I think it's really a huge mistake. It's really a huge mistake. Hey, Rachel, I actually got to meet Rachel at Self-Reliance Festival, and she told me who she was. A little point of irritation here, okay? I'll just say this right now. So there are some of y'all that I met in Tennessee, hung out, told me your name, but you go by a handle online, yeah? When I come home, I post some shit, and the person's like, I enjoyed having a beer with you this weekend. And I'm like, great. I have no idea which one you were because you didn't tell me how I knew you. So if you meet me in public and you go by, like, Rachel's Rachel, I get that. But, like, I'll give you someone who did it right, Hunter. I met Hunter, too. And he told me who he was. He didn't tell me his real name. He told me his screen handle, so I knew it was him. Because I felt bad for a couple. I'm like, oh, wow, that person's always in my feeds or always on Twitter or X or whatever. And, like, I didn't even know who they were. I talked to them, we hung out, whatever, but I didn't even know that I was supposed to know who they were. All right, real quick. Oh, I'm sorry about this throat thing. I don't know what the hell's going on. It's like this tickle itch, and now I'm out of water again. But in the end, do something. Because even if it needs to be a community level thing that you do, it needs to be like partnering up with some locals and finding a local producer and buying from them as a group so that you can make it work or what have you. So, some people, it's straight up a storage capacity issue. I have a friend who would love to go in on large meat buys with me, but he just literally doesn't have the freezer space. He doesn't, and it's not a money issue. Like, he just literally doesn't have, like, the house is full type of situation. And he just doesn't have the room for, like, two big chest freezers to go in or something like that. So sometimes it's not about I can't afford a whole cow. I don't have a space for a whole cow. But if you can put together, let's say, four people to do it, you're buying a quarter beef twice a year. That's like buying a half of beef once a year, but you just have less to deal with at any one time. But the big thing to understand here, and I tried to focus more on the solution today than the problem, but I want to finish coming back to the problem. This is happening. I didn't want to bring up a bunch of examples, but here's just, some of what's going on out there, like right now. So experts say we should tax meat eaters the same way we tax smokers. Now, and think about this. Experts, and we all know experts say means bullshit, but the message to the sheeple is what? Eating red meat is as bad for your health as smoking cigarettes. Now, no one with an IQ, I would believe, over 100 should believe that. But as we discussed earlier, there's a lot of people with an IQ under 100. So they want to tax meat as like a sin tax. Well, I say get ahead of the curve because I already say, like, the way they tax a lot of shit, that is that is the way around it now. I can make vodka for about $1.50. I don't need to be drinking vodka every day or anything. I'm just making a point that most of the cost of most alcohol beverages is in a large part anyway, the taxes on them, plus the marks up and elsewhere. I have another article up here. Climate tax on meat becoming increasingly probable. due to time constraints, I'm not going to play this, but I'll put a link in the show notes today. Here's a Fox News segment from about 10 months ago. UN's beef with U.S. farmers, the UN, that's the United Nations, pushing people to eat less meat. This is happening. Like I said, if you go to Google and you search for war on meat, you'll be greeted with a ton of articles that say you're a conspiracy theorist for even thinking that's a thing. But by the second paragraph, that same source is telling you why you shouldn't eat meat. I mean, isn't that interesting? Oh, there's no war on meat. You have all the meat you want, but you shouldn't eat it. You're killing the planet. You're boiling the oceans. You're going to kill little children and say what, Neo or whatever, right? Like, hold on, wait a minute. You just told me I was crazy. That's a right-wing, Jim Bro white cisgendered concept conspiracy theory that there's a war on meat. That was your opening. That was your first four sentences. You got all that in there. And then the next thing that you tell me is all the reasons I shouldn't be eating the meat that you said there's no war on. I'm sorry, I don't believe you. This is happening, and it's only going to get worse. And, you know, I'm seeing things like you go into I'm not talking like Whole Foods or Central Market. I'm talking like an Albertsons. You go into Albertsons, you know, and there's, I mean, it's good beef, good-looking beef, you know, nicely marbled ribeye behind the counter, not the stuff out in the styrofoam and cellophane. And $22 a pound for ribeye? For ribeye? I'm seeing like good quality, like 85-15 ground beef, $9.99 a pound for ground beef. But on the other side of that, I want you to think about this. Sitting right next to it, $9 a pound, $10 a pound for ground beef. Sitting right next to it. Oh, look at that. Bottom round. $3.99 a pound. How hard is that to bring home, cube up, and put through your grinder? The answer is not hard at all. And the other side of that is most stores, you can pick up two of those bottom rounds or two chucks or whatever's on sale. You can walk your ass right to the meat counter and go, will you grind this for me? And they'll do it. This is how it used to work. 20 years ago when I would do that, I'd be like, hey, can you grind these for me? And they'd go, well, are you sure? Because we have ground. No, I just would like it. Oh, okay, they'll do it. Would you like it coarse or fine ground? That would be the next words out of their mouth, right? I even had one place they said, Mondays and Thursdays early would be the best time. That's when we're running the equipment anyway. It's not cleaned up yet for the day, whatever. Oh, okay, sure. Now they try to talk you out of it, but they'll still usually do it. You know, the meat over there is actually better quality ground meat than this would be. But no, go grind this for me, and they'll usually do it. Personally, I actually enjoy grinding my own meat my own way, cut to my own specifications. It lets me eyeball everything. I end up with additional fat that's great to render out for tallow and things like that. So that's how I'll approach that now. But there's always ways to adapt to this. And I'm just telling you, this is happening. It's happening on just about every level. You know, they have this, it started off with like, we're just going to be healthy and we're going to have meatless Mondays in our cafeteria. There's a full-on war against it now. And they're educating our children in this public indoctrination system that they call education. That you're literally killing the planet if you eat cow. And if you look, I'm just going to say this here at the end. If I believed every word of the global warming hysteria, but at the same time understood the carbon cycle and the best way to take the most carbon out of the atmosphere and put it into soil, then I would be even a bigger advocate of grass-fed beef and pastured pork than I am right now. There is no system that will cycle more carbon out of the atmosphere and into the soil than a properly managed paddock shift, savanna mimic grazing system. Nothing will do more to take carbon out of the air and into the soil than that. We can do a lot with cover crops and proper crop management and no-till growing and stuff that really does pump a lot of carbon into the soil. But I'll tell you, I put it this way. Greg Judy one time said, we're gonna come up with an imaginary machine to cycle carbon and fertility into our soil. This is what the magic machine would do. It would go along and it would remove about one third of the grasses and forbs at any given time from the field. It would mash it up into really fine stuff, and then it would hold it for about 24 hours in a moist environment at right around 100 degrees Fahrenheit until it became a slurry. And then it would deposit it back on the soil as like an oozing mat that would slowly seep into the soil and be consumed by the dung beetles and the worms. And he's like, and the good news is we have this machine. And the last thing we would want to do is burn fossil fuel to make it work. So we would make it solar powered. And we have that too. It's called a cow. It's called a cow. So I don't care what you think about environmentalism, global warming, climate change, climate. You put any name you want to on it. If you are a full-on believer, this is actually the way to make things better. And then if you are a much larger, broader-minded environmentalist, if you don't, like, if you disagree with me about global warming, that's fine. That's fine. If you notice, unless you know my position, I didn't even tell you what it was today, did I? Because I don't care. But no matter what, you should be thinking much broader than CO2. What about waste running into our waters and our streams? What about dead zones in our oceans? What about all this nutrient flowing down the Mississippi River and destroying an area of the Gulf of Mexico every year that's bigger than the state of Delaware? What about that? And Delaware's a lot bigger state than you think it is, by the way. Look at it vertically. It's a lot bigger than you think it is. It's an awful big dead zone. It's an awful big dead zone every year that this happens. And what does that? Mostly nitrogen-based fertilizer runoff from farms. It's not cattle. It's not cattle. Go up the Mississippi River. It's not lined on both sides with cattle. It's lined with cornfields and wheat fields and soybean fields and rice. That's where it comes from. There is no need to till to graze cattle. When we stop tilling, a lot of the problem right there goes away. We keep living root in the soil and armor on the soil. But if we're also cycling the vegetation, because here's what people don't understand. And if you take my cover crop course, which we'll talk about in just a second, you'll learn this. When you see all that vegetation on the top of the ground, let's say for a cover crop, and we put that to the ground somehow, we kill it, and we leave it like a mulch, and it rots. We think it rots into the soil. Some of it does end up in the soil. Arthropods, macro and micro arthropods, worms and stuff will cycle some of it down into the soil. But most of it literally off-gasses. It's released back into the atmosphere. The carbon buildup in the soil from cover cropping is mostly the roots left in the soil when the plant's either cut and comes back and the roots pulse off and they basically self-prune, or when the plant dies and the roots die in the soil. It's in the soil. It stays in the soil. It becomes incorporated in the soil. When we graze it, whether it's my ducks and geese graze like little cows, or it's an actual cow, or it's a sheep, or it's a goat, or it's a deer, and they eat it and they turn it into poop and they put that in the soil, that is extremely valuable to soil organisms, and so they rapidly consume and incorporate it. So a grazed system is going to put way more carbon into, especially a perennial-based grazing system, is going to put more carbon in the soil than the best, perfectly managed annual cover crop rotation system. One's good, the other's just better. So no matter what you think about this, I want you to understand that the way to heal the planet is properly managing ruminants in so many ways. It's not the only answer, but it's a hell of a good answer, and it's a hell of a good start. And it would fix a lot of the problem. If we add other things we talk about, like biochar and stuff to it, we can really go a long way really, really fast to putting us back to where we historically were as a planet, which is much more imbalanced than where we are now. And I'll end with this. There has never been a civilization built on annual crops that didn't eventually collapse. And that when it collapsed, the annual cropping wasn't part of, not the cause of, but part of the cause of the collapse. Egyptian society collapsed because annual agriculture failed more than anything else. For all the discussion about debasing the money in Rome and the corollaries to us and the Roman Empire collapsing, you know what happened? the grain that the empire ran on stopped being produced sufficiently so that they could feed everybody the bread to go with their circuses. Every society has ever built its entire livelihood on annual agriculture has collapsed infinity. And we are not so smart that we've broken that cycle. The solution is in understanding natural systems, and broad-scale natural systems contain animals. Broad-scale natural systems contain animals, period. Anyway, real quick, let's do a few questions and things, and if you don't see yours come up, there's six, you can have one more chance to get a question in. Amy B. says, gas money, thanks for not running ads, and it's $20 super chat. Amy, thank you so much. Kurt says, duck type, Muscovy or other. Yes. Yes. I will tell you that I have an episode that's something along the lines of like Muscovy ducks, the best bird for the most people or something like that. Or are they the perfect poultry or something to that effect. I love Muscovies. My problem with them here is I do have some predator issues. They're very broody, and they inevitably don't brood in the duck house. So all of a sudden, the girl just disappears, and sometimes she comes back with a bunch of little ducklings, and you're happy, but there's other times they disappear, and you never find them again until you find where their nest was and a big pile of busted eggshells and feathers and bones because a raccoon or a bobcat or something found them because they won't go to bed. They go into that wild state. So I think that's going to be dependent for you on where you are. And, you know, when they go into that broody mode, do you maybe confine them to an area where you can protect them or something like that? But I love Muscovies. Muscovies to me are about the perfect bird other than that one issue because their meat is incredibly high quality. It really is kind of like baby beef in flavor. They're quiet. They lay a lot of eggs. They're just a much shorter lay period than a mallard breed duck. But I love both of them. I love both of them. Nurse Wang says, what fish would you recommend for a pool that is converted to a natural swimming pond? Bluegills, catfish, primarily. I mean, it depends on where you live. If you live South Florida, it's hard to be tilapia. I know people say they don't have any flavor, but that means you didn't put any flavor in the fish. Tilapia tastes like whatever you want them to. I've had some delicious tilapia. I've had some plain Jane boring tilapia too. But to me, unless you can keep the water temperature warm enough, they don't die in your winter. You're much better off with something else. And but if you live way in the north, you know, you might do actual perch like yellow perch, or you might do trout. Trout here, they're going to die. They're not going to make it through our summers. So I like to use local fish. That's something that lives where you are. Local fish are adapted to your local water type and quality and to localized diseases and to local climate. So most of my fish come from little streams and farm ponds and park ponds around here. Take my grandson fishing. We come home. The last time we went, we came home with like 20 bluegills. And they weren't bluegills. They're bluegills and pumpkin seeds and stuff like that. And like 9 bullheads. And we just threw them all in the pond behind the duck house. And the best course of action is to keep records so you know what you've done and how much you've taken out. And then account for like a 10% mortality per annum there. But, you know, use something local. Gamer Time said, what is my opinion on guinea pig? I personally think that guinea pig is interesting. I am not opposed to eating it. I don't think it's very productive from a energy in, meat out standpoint. It was, you know, it's kind of like a South American thing that is more like in societies where meat was a rare treat, having the ability to keep those critters, you know, very easily and what have you. But if I was going to do a dedicated meat animal, I would do rabbits way before guinea pigs. Now, I've seen some systems where guinea pigs are native, like Central and South America systems, where they're actually raising guinea pigs in like milpa systems in the wild. That would be different. I would have a different opinion on that. But I guess I would, in my climate, we don't have native guinea pigs, but we have squirrels. I like squirrels. I eat squirrels. Sometimes I'll see a squirrel in a tree and a dog will look at the squirrel and be like, hey, you know, go get the boomstick. I go get the boomstick and bam, squirrel comes out of the tree and we skin the squirrel and we throw it on the grill and we have it together. I'll share it with the dog because she helped. But I'm not going to raise squirrels because you're looking at, you know, what, 3/4 of a pound of meat from a big squirrel if you're lucky, where I could get a rabbit and in a very reasonable amount of time grow out a rabbit kit that I have to do no work for, by the way, to a meal for 2 or 3 people easily. And to me, so the problem with guinea pig isn't its edibility, it's quantity out. And I think it, all the research I've done about where they're actually eaten, it's more like this kind of like luxury thing that even the poor can have, is the way it is. I do remember Bill Mollison talking about this way that they prepared, and it could be one of his bullshit stories, but he's like, so they heat this rock up really, really high, and then they take the guinea pig and they dispatch it, and then they put him on the hot rock, and they take another great huge hot rock, and they flatten him like a pancake, and they cook him between the hot rocks over the fire, and he's drawing this on the blackboard, and then right in the middle, he draws this little white dot. And he says, and then they always have this little dot on them. And he's like, he's like, do you know what the dot is? And nobody knows. He's like, that's its soul, right? So that's why I think he might have been BSing a bit. Hey, Alabama says, do you put a ring in the pig's nose to keep them from rooting out of the fence? I do not, because I don't raise pigs. And I have not heard the greatest results with ringing pig noses. And most people I know that do like pastured pigs and all don't do that. There are specific breeds of pigs that are known for not being rooters, if you want to do that. But based on prior conversations I've had with people that have raised pigs, they're generally not the most productive pigs. Backwoods Butcher was on talking about that recently. And then Bill says, hey, Alabama says, Bill, and I think he means Billy as in Billy Bond, throws the race and gender card if he needs to. He does. So for those that don't know Billy, Billy's a black dude. And he'll use that a little bit to guilt like a university cafeteria into giving him food. He had this whole thing he did about being gay and taking somebody. And I said I would go with him and be like his husband and be like, honey, come on. They don't care about saving the planet here. He'll play that up and use it against them. Another question from Chris here. What percentage of a rabbit litter do you typically see survive? Whole litters or individual losses within a litter? I'm not a rabbit. I don't raise rabbits. But most of the people I know that raise rabbits, you know, they may maybe lose a kit per litter if they have a good mother, you know. And if they don't have a good mother, then she graduates and gets replaced. Hudson says, question, bullhead or channel? Both. But I do a lot more bullheads now because it's a lot easier to catch bullheads than channel cats in quantity in my area. And most of the channel cats that I catch that are legal are significantly legal and already ready to graduate. So, for instance, I went out a couple months ago and tried out a new spot, and I caught like a 2.5-pound channel cat, and he's not swimming in the pond. He's long ago been in my belly. Where with bullheads, they don't have a legal size or quantity limit. So, you know, I bring bullheads home all the time at 3-4 inches long. Best bait in the world for them, salted shrimp. Salted shrimp. All you do, buy the cheapest shrimp you can get from like Walmart, raw. The one thing it has to be is raw, not cooked. Put it in a Tupperware bowl and cover it with salt. Just plain, like kosher salt for about a day. Then pull it out of the salt. The salt will be very wet at that point. So, like, when you do this, throw the shrimp into a colander and let it defrost and let all that water, that shrimp nasty stink water, come out of it before you put it in the salt. That way it will be less wet when you do it in the salt. Pull it out of the salt, leave some salt on it, throw it in a Ziploc bag, throw it in the refrigerator. It'll last forever like that. Take the bucket of salt, the Tupperware thing of salt, for the next time you need to make some, put it in the sun for a couple days. It'll completely dry out, and you can reuse it almost infinitely and just add more when you need to. So there's that. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and wrap up. I want to remind you guys, if you want to know more about building soil, we have an excellent course available now at Home Food Systems called the Backyard Cover Crop and Soil Secrets Course. I put months of work into developing the syllabus, the lessons, the exams. This course is one of the best things I've ever put together. You'll learn about a tremendous variety of plants. If you look right here on the screen right now, that's my garden this year. In full growth cycle with, you know, there's basil and peppers and things like that. But see the interplanted flowers and stuff. I teach you all of this stuff, how to build the best soil you've ever built in your life, right in your garden, the way that nature does it. If you want to take this course, again, you can find it at homefoodsystems.com. And again, if you are like me and you eat mostly meat and you're doing, you could still be growing food for your food and have less dependency than on the feed store. Next up today, another way you can help us out, do your online shopping. Where? tspaz.com, T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. Start your shopping there. You help us out no matter what you buy. If anything, the last couple weeks with the hurricanes and all, I should have taught you the value of backup power. My favorite electronics brand out there today is Anker, A-N-K-E-R. Yesterday I had one of their other products, a Bluetooth speaker. Today they have their 26,000 milliamp hour backup power system on sale for like 36% off. And they have their smaller one, the 20,000 milliamp hour one, on sale for like 40% off. These are great. They are absolute beasts, the amount of power they provide for backup power. They don't go on sale often. Anker is already a value brand, so their price is already pretty low. But when they are on sale, is a good time to pick them up, and I highly recommend you consider one of these. Last but not least, consider becoming a member of the MSB. If you're an MSB member and you take my backyard cover crop course, get $10 off. $15 off. The compost course, you get $5 off. That's $20 right there just in my courses. We have about 70 other vendors that do discounts. You want to check them out. And real quick, I just want to let you guys know, I have not heard from Rand at Akira Botanical, but I heard from yesterday in a comment or somewhere this morning, his mom had said that he is in North Carolina where a lot, like the town he's actually based in, is just wiped out. So I don't know how he's doing with his business, if it's going to recover, if it's been damaged. I really don't know, but Rand does a great discount for us that is probably worth being a member alone for. And just I want you to think about, there's a lot of people out there that are in these impacted zones. And we tend to think of the people like lost their house and what have you. And I'm not making light of it. I'm just saying there are people that maybe their life is still somewhat okay, but their business is highly disrupted. And it would be like you losing your job if you don't have a business, if you have just a job. And in some ways, it's worse because you're not collecting unemployment or something like that when you're like a solopreneur or a small business. So just something else. There's a lot to think about with helping people right now. So wherever and at however you can, please try to reach out and help somebody with that. I'm going to sign off before my throat deconstructs itself here. Take care, guys. I'll catch you tomorrow with an episode on Raising Backyard Plants.
You should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.